Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody. Long time no see, hear, all that great thing. This is your girl, Raven the Serial Poet, on Raven's Real Spill, come to bring to y'all the first night of 31 Days of Horror. Now, I know I've been in a hiatus for a minute. I've seen the inbox, I got the emails. And I want to say, yes, I am fine. Yes, I have been going through some things with my health. But also, I just want to say thank y'all for the support. Thank y'all for the listening. I know a lot of y'all was listening to the older shows while I've been gone. I appreciate that as well. But for the most part, I'm just glad to be back. So, make sure you lock your doors, lock your windows. If you're in the house by yourself, cuddle on up. If you have a loved one, you know what I'm saying, grab that loved one and pull them close. And make sure that whatever snacks you need, that you have them. Because tonight, and for the next 30 days after, prepare to be entertained. So with that being said, if you want to call in, the number is 914-205-5813. That is 914-205-5813. Call in and come get in on these horror tales. So before we get into the first one, I only have one thing to say, and that is, yeah, some of these scenarios sounds about right. So that's all I'm going to say. With that being said, let's get into it.
Hello.
I was out doing a delivery one late night. It was probably the longest drive I have ever taken for a pizza delivery. From the pizza place I worked at, it was a 20-minute drive, which isn't too crazy out where I live. Plus, they ordered 4 large pies, so I figured it was a party and I would get a much bigger tip. Navigating the dirt roads at night was always annoying, though. I pulled up to the given address. It was some old, sketchy-looking building, literally in the middle of a forest clearing. There were no cars parked anywhere, or any lights on. I put my car in park and called my boss. I asked him to reread the address at least 3 times to make sure I typed it in right, but that checked out. I could tell he was in a really bitchy mood, and he told me to at least knock on the door and check it out. He would normally get mad if we took back 1 pie, but I was afraid of what he would do if I brought back 4. I was insanely unnerved, but got out anyway and forced myself to the front door of the building. There was no doorbell, so I just knocked really hard. I heard nothing and didn't really expect to hear anything. I was extremely disappointed, not because nobody answered the door, but because I was realizing that it was all a waste of time and gas. I knocked 1 more time out of desperation, and then began to hear some kind of rustling noises from inside of the building. I knocked again and yelled that I was the pizza guy. There was silence now. I felt a bit more uncomfortable now than before, but before I could turn around, I noticed something at the window. There was someone looking through the window. I couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. All I noticed were their eyes. Their eyes were open wider than I knew possible, staring intently at me. I was disturbed enough by this and dropped the pizzas and ran back to my car. The shitty thing wouldn't start until turning the key for the 3rd time. I drove off the grass and back onto the dirt road, but I felt the car rocking about, shaking and bumping. Something wasn't right. I didn't make it far from the building before I started hearing a sharp scraping sound coming from outside. There was so much resistance that I couldn't even drive. The car came to a stop. I got out of the car to check what the hell was wrong. A chill ran up my spine as I began to feel like my heart was constantly skipping beats. My tires had been slashed and had completely fallen off the rim. Not just the front, though. All 4 tires were slashed. I realized somebody did this when I was knocking on the door to that building. Instead of running, I got back in the car and locked the doors. I was so close to that building, I could practically see it from where I was, if it weren't for the trees blocking the view. I dialed 911 and explained everything to the operator. She told me the cops would be over as soon as possible and that I need to stay hidden. I asked her if it was advisable to stay in the car or run, and she told me it would be best to stay in the car with the door locked. She asked me to stay on the line with her until the cops arrived. My whole body was shaking. In all directions, there was nothing but dark, seemingly endless forest. I knew it would take forever for the cops to get there. I was not comfortable with sitting in that car so close to whoever did this. The next part, though, is what utterly destroyed me. It still shakes me to this day, and I hope nobody ever has to experience this kind of fear. As I was scanning all the windows, making sure nobody was outside, I looked in the rearview mirror, and there was the same person I saw at that window. Eyes open wider than ever. I could see now that it was a woman, and I could ever so slightly see a smile begin to spread across her face. I opened my door and full-on sprinted into the woods, not caring how much noise I made. I ran until I was out of breath, which didn't take long, and I hid behind a giant log on the ground. I tried to cover my loud breathing with my hands as I waited and waited for what felt like hours, until I finally heard sirens in the distance. I gathered up all the stamina I had left to run all the way back in the direction of the dirt road. Eventually, the glowing red and blue lights came into view, and I had never felt better in my life. They were parked in front of my car, investigating with flashlights. I came out yelling at them like a lunatic to help me. I fell to the floor and started to gag, almost throwing up from running so much. They picked me up and began to question me, to which I explained everything to the best of my ability. One of the two cars drove over to the building, and the two officers began to search the building. They came back with nothing except for a couple of spiky objects. These objects were exactly the same as the ones used to slash my tires. The cops guessed that it was some kind of sick, demented couple, being that I saw the woman, but unfortunately they were never found, and that still kills me to this day. I obviously quit my job right after that and started working at a local grocery store. I know that I'll never forget seeing that woman at the back of my car. I recently moved out, and I already have a horror story to tell. The house I moved into isn't anything impressive, it's just a house that's appropriate for one or two people. But I'd say right away, I started hearing weird sounds coming from inside the walls. I first heard it in the kitchen, and then in the bathroom, but on night three, I started hearing it in my bedroom. I was sure there was some kind of animal living in my walls. I just had to figure out how to get rid of it. The next morning, I didn't even have enough milk to fill the bowl of cereal. I couldn't believe I hadn't realized I needed more milk. In fact, I seemed to be eating up all of my food pretty fast. I woke up in the middle of that night to the sound of breathing. Not my breathing. It sounded just like the breathing of a person. I flipped the lamp on, and it stopped. I chalked it up as my mind playing tricks on me after waking up. The next day was really hot, so I turned on the AC for the first time. I checked every single vent, and some of them weren't blowing any air, one of them being the vent right next to my bed. I peered through the vent with a flashlight. There wasn't even a duct behind the vent. It was just the inside of the wall. It seemed that whatever air duct was in there had been removed. Unfortunately, I didn't look into the air conditioning system while buying the house, so I didn't know about this. That night, I had to sleep in the heat with no AC, so I was up pretty late, constantly rolling around and flipping the pillow over. Then, I eventually started to hear the breathing again, but this time, I was fully awake. I knew it was real this time. It was coming to my left. I looked to my left at the air vents. The sound was surely coming from in there. I grabbed the flashlight again and shined it in through the vent. I dropped it and screamed. There was someone's face peering through the cracks of the vents. The first thing I saw were their eyes, open wide and glowing. I screamed all the way down and out the house. I soon found out there was a crazy, dangerous homeless man living in my walls, and he had been eating my food ever since I moved in. I was doing some night hog hunting in the woods near my backyard. I was hiding in the tower I had built about a decade ago. In case anyone's wondering, I of course had a night vision scope attachment. I guess I'm what you would consider a hardcore hunter. I don't want to bore you with the unnecessary story prolonging details, so I'll make this short. And I want everyone to know that though I agree this story sounds far-fetched and crazy, it is nothing but the truth. And I, in a way, actually consider myself lucky that I'll always have such a horrifying story to share. So, while I was sitting in the tower waiting for movement, it finally came. I took aim and found the source. But it wasn't at all a hog, or any kind of animal I was expecting. It was a person, a man wearing all black, black sweatpants, black shoes, and a black hoodie with the hood over his head. But that wasn't the freakiest part. He was dragging a sack behind him. My heart started racing. I was pretty sure I was witnessing this guy trying to bury a body. I continued to watch him, but then he slowed down, and I swear to God, it looked as if he turned his head up to me. I ducked down under the wooden walls of the tower, shaking in my boots. Yes, I had a gun, but just the idea of using it against a person is horrifying. I lay low, praying to God that he hadn't seen me. It wouldn't make sense if he could, though. It's practically pitch black out here, or at least, that was my logic. Seconds felt like an eternity as I waited for the footsteps in the leaves to move elsewhere, but I didn't hear any footsteps. All I heard was the sound of a foot hitting one of the wooden planks on the ladder of the tower. I felt the entire tower vibrate and shake as there were two more steps moving up the ladder. At this point, I was asking myself deep down, am I going to be able to shoot someone? But for some reason, whoever was down there decided not to climb all the way up, as I heard them jump back down to the forest ground and began dragging the sack away. I think I stayed frozen like a statue for at least 10 minutes before even peeking over the ledge again. The coast seemed clear. I had to get home and warn the police immediately. I hopped over the ledge and descended down the ladder. I turned on my pocket flashlight, which in hindsight was a stupid move considering the situation, and ran back in the direction of my house. I was only able to run for about 10 seconds or so when I heard the rapid, manic footsteps crunching the leaves from behind me. I took a look over my shoulder, and there he was, inches away from my face. I spun around and shot him in the shoulder. He stopped and screamed in agony, and I took that moment to finish my dash to my house. Again, in hindsight, I should have held him hostage somehow, but that doesn't even matter now. I called the police, who showed up within 15 minutes with a whole search squad, and I led them all into the woods to the exact location where I shot him. There was a faint yet noticeable blood trail spilled onto the leaves which led past the body bag, which the cops seized, and eventually right to the maniac, who was hiding under a log next to a tree. He was arrested and tried for the murder of Jinquen Sakanaki, a Japanese corner store owner. I don't know the full story behind it, but I do know I won't forget this one for the rest of my life, and I'll also be telling it for the rest of my life. I'll never forget the time me and my brother snuck out past our bedtimes to explore an allegedly haunted house down the block. Yes, I said bedtime, as I was only 10 and my brother Luke was only 12. When our parents said goodnight to us, I went to Luke's room and we took a couple hand-powered flashlights with us and hopped outside through the window. Luckily, his room was on the first floor. Those hand-powered flashlights worked by constantly pushing in a little trigger that would create light inside the lens. They were noisy as hell, but they were convenient. Once we were outside, we just walked down the block, and in 2 minutes we were there. It was rumored by all the neighborhood kids and teens that the place was haunted. Everything about it was creepy. The older, more antique design of the house, the isolation from the rest of the houses, and the broken windows and rotting wood. It seemed perfect for a horror movie. We went around to the backyard. This was all my curious and confident brother's idea. I was scared shitless. The door was locked, as expected. I felt a bit of relief, thinking we might just go home, but my brother made a shocking move next. He grabbed a plank of wood laying in the grass and began smashing the already chipped window. Eventually, there was enough of an opening to unlock it and slide it up completely. We hopped inside and began cranking those noisy-ass flashlights. Immediately after entering the house, we both picked up on the fact that it was like 90 degrees in there, which was odd as it was a September night in the mid-70s. There was no graffiti or anything anywhere. In fact, it was relatively empty besides a few pieces of furniture that were clearly not worth taking along. It seemed we were the first to enter the house, shockingly, or at least from the back. We went upstairs to the main floor from the little den area and continued cranking the flashlights. That's when we heard the slightest crack in the floorboards from right above us. We both jumped. I tugged for Luke to leave, but he told me the place is old as hell. It's just house noises. I stopped cranking the flashlight at this point, and I urged Luke to do the same, but he only called me stupid for suggesting something so ridiculous. Then there was another crack in the floorboards from above us. He began walking upstairs. I didn't want to go up there, but I was not about to stay down there alone. I followed behind him to the upstairs. There was a door that led to a room right above where we were standing. I begged him not to open it, but he must have just wanted to be the big, tough older brother. He began to reach for the doorknob while still cranking the noisy flashlight, but then he stopped. I was confused. I could see in the dark he was moving his ear up against the door, listening for something. Silence. Then, the most deafening, nightmare-inducing moment of my life. A single bang on the door from the other side sent my brother staggering into the wall in pain, covering his ear. We dropped the flashlights and ran straight out the back door and back home. We were so loud when we got back that our parents found us out. We told them what happened, but they naturally didn't care and grounded us both for a week. 2 nights later, I woke to the sound of something from outside my window and a glare of brightness sneaking in through my slightly opened blind. I sat up and my heart sank when I realized it was the sound of the crank to my flashlight. I stood up and looked out the window, and that's when it stopped. There was nothing but complete blackness out there after that. I woke the next day barely remembering what happened, and I still hope today that that part was just a dream. This story took place a long time ago, back in 2002, when Craigslist was in its early years. Many wouldn't know, but back in those days, Craigslist was a lot different. It was a lot more so an online garage sale, or just a place where people would list old things that still had some value that they were willing to give away. I got a basketball hoop, a hockey net, and a spoiler for my car, all free in perfect condition in that same year. You'd be lucky if you found something like that these days. Anyway, me and my son were dying to buy a hockey net so we could practice in the cul-de-sac we lived in. For the record, this was before I got that free one I mentioned. Wouldn't you know it, on Craigslist there was an ad for a slightly used regulation size hockey goal for only $50. It came with a puck and two slightly used hockey sticks. I still have a picture of that ad to this day. It seemed like the perfect deal, but he lived about 2 hours away. I called the number he had listed, and he sounded pretty normal on the phone. He had a pretty deep, dark voice, but nothing that would be off-putting. I remember his voice being a bit emotionless. He agreed to meet halfway due to the distance, said he'd put the stuff in the back of his pickup truck. He said he could only come after he got off from work, though, which was much later in the day, way past dark. We agreed to meet at some rest stop off the highway. Me and my son, who was 11 at the time, took my wife's minivan, the only car that would be able to fit that huge thing. Within an hour, we were at the truck stop, which was empty at this hour, but was decently lit by three big light posts. I parked right under one of the lights and waited. A pickup truck pulled in off the highway right on time. He stopped right in front of me. I went over to his window, but then noticed there was nothing in the back of his truck. "You Steve?" he asked me. "Yep, that's me," I said. "Alright, my buddy's bringing in the stuff with his truck." The guy pulled up behind my car and put it in park. I suddenly had a bad feeling. I told my son to get back in the car and lock every door except mine. Two more pairs of headlights came off the highway into the lots. Surely enough, pulling up next to me. And, not surprisingly at this point, there was no hockey equipment in either one of them. My heart was racing. I was worried. Not for me, but for my young son who I, for some reason, brought with me on this trip. A group of large men mixed with heavy-set and muscular physiques stepped out of the two pickup trucks behind the first one. They eyed me from head to toe, giving that typical intimidation stare down. Then this bald guy wearing sunglasses said in a deep voice, "Where's the money?" I instantly pulled out my wallet and handed it to him, begging him to just let me and my son go. He pulled out like $100 and was pissed, expecting more. He then sent two of his goons or whatever to get my son. At this point, I screamed and begged for him not to take him. One of the men broke the glass to the minivan back door, and I vividly remember the disturbing, heartbreaking screams of my young son. What happened next was what I can only explain to be a miracle from God answering my prayers. A car was entering the lot from off the highway. All the men stopped and turned to look at it. As it got closer, my heart literally dropped in excitement as I saw it was a police car. The light suddenly began to flash as he got close enough to see what was going on. All of the men were back in their trucks within seconds, speeding off down the highway. Well, at least two of them. The truck in the back was caught immediately by the police car, and backup arrived shortly. I explained everything to them, and they got the men that were caught to rat out on the others surprisingly quickly. I guess luckily the guys in the back truck weren't very loyal to whoever their leader was, if they even had any type of leader. Believe it or not, I had a police escort all the way home to make me and my son feel safer. I don't want to get into all the legal stuff, but I'll just say that all of those men except for one was caught, and I'm pretty sure that was the driver of the first pickup truck. Needless to say, my Craigslist days weren't over at that point, but I have always been much more protective of my son and much more cautious of Craigslist meetings since then. There was once an isolated island off the coast of Scotland where three lighthouse keepers lived and were responsible for keeping the building intact. One day, when their monthly supply ship dropped in, the island was silent. No response from the lighthouse keepers. Eventually, the captain and some crew members went to investigate and found a disturbingly empty lighthouse. Two of the three waterproof coats were missing from their hangars, and the kitchen was left in a state as if people had left in a hurry. The lighthouse log only added more mystery to the situation. The log described how one of the keepers wouldn't talk, and the other continuously cried for hours. All this pain and fear seemed to be coming from what was referred to as a powerful storm looming in the distance. However, this begs the question, why were they so scared of a simple storm? They should have been safe in the brand new lighthouse, right? The log goes on to talk about how they all sat close together and prayed for the storm to be over. The final log states, "The storm has passed, the skies are calm, and God is over all." Their bodies were never found, and the cause of their death is still a mystery to this day. The most accepted theory is that they somehow got swept out to sea during the storm, never to be seen again. But one final detail remains, one that scared the captain and his crew to the bone. The powerful storm described in the log didn't exist. There were no storms reported in the area. In fact, the skies were calm all day. It was 2 years ago. I was called in to do the night shift, 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. at 7-Eleven, since somebody called out. The store was located on a busy road in a rather quiet and rural area. During the night shift, you could expect anywhere from 10 to 20 people come in to buy a beer or something else. This one particular night, there was this one guy, mid-20s, that came in. He started making weird noises, like loud yelling noises. I assumed he had some kind of mental disability. In fact, my brother has a mental disability, so I immediately felt sympathy for the guy. He walked up to the counter without any items, with his head facing me, but his eyes were looking up at the ceiling. I felt uncomfortable. I honestly didn't know how to deal with it. I tried speaking with him, but he only responded in loud noises. I kept checking if he was with someone outside, but he was alone. There weren't any cars in the parking lot, so I assumed he walked. He stood there for so long, looking up at the ceiling and making noises, that I tried to get him out by handing him a bag of chips and telling him he can go. I tried finding some kind of number to call for someone to help him. Then, out of nowhere, he finally turned around and walked out of the store. I felt so horrible for the man, but at the same time, I felt a bit creeped out. About an hour later, the phone on the counter rang. I picked up to hear the familiar yelling sounds of the man from earlier. It caught me off guard. I didn't know what to think, other than this has to be some kind of prank. I hung up on them and was now becoming paranoid of my surroundings, constantly checking the outside through the windows. Come 4 o'clock, the person working after me came in, finally allowing for me to go home. It wasn't my problem anymore. I got home and threw all my stuff on the table, ready to get to sleep. But my phone rang within a minute after entering the door. I felt a chill run down my spine. Why would someone be calling at 4 a.m.? I could only imagine it was bad news. I braced myself and picked up the phone to hear the man again. I felt sick to my stomach as I listened to the loud noises he made. I struggled to slam the phone to the receiver. All night, I felt like I was being watched, even with all the blinds shut. And I could swear I heard strange noises coming from all over my house. I refused to get any sleep until the sun came up. Weeks passed, and I had forgotten about the incident, until one day, when going into the basement for the first time in a while, I found that papers had been scattered all over the floor, and when I went into the basement closet, I found writing on the walls. 7-Eleven had been written in Sharpie on the wall, along with the address to the 7-Eleven I worked at and my house address. The most disturbing part, I also found various kitchen knives along with a large pocket knife sitting in the closet. What started out as seemingly just an innocent person turning into something of a prank ultimately turned into something much more horrifying. He had been living down there for God knows how long, and I'm just grateful that for whatever reason he changed his mind and left, because I haven't seen or heard from him since. All I can say is that man is dangerously ill. About 5 years ago, I lived downtown in a major city in the U.S. I've always been a night person, so I would often find myself bored after my roommate, who was decidedly not a night person, went to sleep. To pass the time, I used to go for long walks and spend the time thinking. I spent 4 years like that, walking alone at night, and never once had a reason to feel afraid. I always used to joke with my roommates that even the drug dealers in the city were polite. But all that changed in just a few minutes of one evening. It was a Wednesday, somewhere between 1 and 2 in the morning, and I was walking near a police-patrolled park quite a ways from my apartment. It was a quiet night, even for a weeknight, with very little traffic and almost no one on foot. The park, as it was most nights, was completely empty. I went down a short side street in order to loop back down my apartment when I first noticed him. At the far end of the street, on my side, was the silhouette of a man dancing. It was a strange dance, similar to a waltz, but he finished each box with an odd forward stride. I guess you could say he was dance walking, headed straight for me. Deciding he was probably drunk, I stepped as close as I could to the road to give him the majority of the sidewalk to pass me. The closer he got, the more I realized how gracefully he was moving. He was very tall and lanky and wearing an old suit. He danced closer still until I could make out his face. His eyes were open wide and wild, head tilted back slightly, looking off at the sky. His mouth was formed in a painfully wide cartoon of a smile. Between the eyes and the smile, I decided to cross the street before he danced any closer. I took my eyes off of him to cross the empty street, As I reached the other side, I glanced back, and then stopped dead in my tracks. He had stopped dancing and was standing with one foot in the street, perfectly parallel to me. He was facing me, but still looking skyward, smile still wide on his lips. I was completely and utterly unnerved by this. I started walking again, but kept my eyes on the man. He didn't move. Once I had put about half a block between us, I turned away from him for a moment to watch the sidewalk in front of me. The street and sidewalk ahead of me were completely empty. Still unnerved, I looked back to where he had been standing to find him gone. For the briefest of moments, I felt relieved until I noticed him. He had crossed the street and was now slightly crouched down. I couldn't tell for sure due to the distance and the shadows, but I was certain he was facing me. I had looked away from him for no more than 10 seconds, so it was clear that he had moved fast. I was so shocked, and I stood there for some time, staring at him, and then he started moving toward me again. He took giant, exaggerated, tiptoed steps, as if he were a cartoon character sneaking up on someone, except he was moving very, very quickly. I'd like to say at this point that I ran away or pulled out my pepper spray or cell phone or anything at all, but I didn't. I just stood there, completely frozen, as the smiling man crept toward me. And then he stopped again, about a car length away from me, still smiling his smile, still looking to the sky. When I finally found my voice, I blurted out the first thing that came to mind. What I meant to ask was, "What the fuck do you want?" in an angry, commanding tone. What came out was a whimper. What the fuck? Regardless of whether or not humans can smell fear, they can certainly hear it. I heard it in my own voice. That only made me more afraid. But he didn't react to it at all. He just stood there, smiling. And then, after what felt like forever, he turned around, very slowly, and started dance walking away. Just like that. Not wanting to turn my back to him again, I just watched him go until he was far enough away to almost be out of sight. And then I realized something. He wasn't moving away anymore, nor was he dancing. I watched in horror as the distant shape of him got bigger and bigger. He was coming back my way. He was coming back my way, and this time he was running. I ran too. I ran until I was off the side road and back onto a better lit road with sparse traffic. Looking behind me then, he was nowhere to be found. The rest of my way home, I kept glancing over my shoulder, always expecting to see his stupid smile, but he was never there. I lived in that city for 6 months after that, and I never went out for another walk. There was something about his face that always haunted me. He didn't look drunk. He didn't look high. He looked completely and utterly insane. And that's a very, very scary thing to see. So me and a couple of my buddies went camping last summer alongside the Willamette River. We actually had a decent hike into the deep end of woods. We did some night fishing, listening to music, and basically drank to the point where everything was funny later in the night. I would guess we finally called it a night somewhere past 2 a.m. I shared a tent with one of my buds while the other two shared another tent. We heard them laughing about something. At first we laughed at the sound of their laughing, but it soon got annoying and we yelled for them to shut up. One of them responded, "It isn't us." I sat up, startled at the response. I came to realize that it was the sound of only one person laughing, and it didn't sound like either one of my friends. Even in my drunk state, I realized how odd it was for somebody to be out this far in the woods so late at night. The laughing gradually got closer and louder to our campout. My friend shot up and looked at me with a worried look on his face. I heard my other friends scream over to us, but they were getting freaked out. As the laughing got even closer, I could make it out very clearly to be the laugh of a male, probably in his 30s or 40s. He sounded like he was as drunk as us, messing around with friends. But we only heard his laugh, nobody else. There was something indescribably creepy about his laugh, too. As if it was missing something to it. You had to be there to understand what I mean. The laughing was now just at the edge of our campsite. But we couldn't hear any footsteps at all. Now that may not seem like a big deal. It was impossible to move through that without making noise. And finally, all of a sudden, the laughing stopped completely. We had no idea where whoever that was standing, as he hadn't made a single stepping sound. We sat there in silence looking at each other. My friend was clearly freaking out, but he was keeping it together the best he could. Finally, something broke the silence. The sound of something rubbing against the cottony fabric of the tent. We saw the outline of a hand through the moonlight, pressing on the tent. We both screamed at the top of our lungs before getting out of the tent. We ran as fast as we could through the woods, our other friends following us. After about 5 minutes of running, we somehow found our car. I actually puked from running so much before taking the wheel. I don't condone drinking and driving, but I still believe we were just in this situation. By far the most horrific experience of my life. No idea who or what the hell that was, or what they wanted. I was having a horrifying dream, possibly the most disturbing nightmare of my life. I was in my house, or the closest thing to my house that my dream could produce. Ironically enough, I was in bed in this dream, or at least I can only start remembering past the point of my lying in bed, and all of a sudden, the sound came from downstairs. I walked downstairs in the dark, not turning on any lights, to where I thought the sound was coming from. I was on my middle floor now. The dream was telling me to go downstairs to my laundry room, and so I did. But as I got there, expecting the noise to be louder and closer, it sounded like it was just as far as before. Now I was going upstairs to the kitchen, and it's strange, outside of every window was complete blackness, not general nighttime darkness. There was nothingness. I think all that existed in this dream was my house. Now my dream started to suggest that the banging sounds were coming from upstairs, so I went back upstairs, and was eventually led to the attic door. It was surely beyond that door. I opened it. There was an old woman standing by a bunch of boxes. She was slowly but loudly slamming her hand on one of the boxes, producing an unnatural sound. I tried to quietly step back away from the attic, but the old woman turned around, opened her mouth twice as wide as anyone humanly could, reached out her arms, began to scream, and leap toward me. That's when I woke up. I thought it was just a horrific dream, but when I heard a bang coming from downstairs, a bang similar to what I heard in my dream, I felt my heart completely drop. On my way downstairs, there was another bang. It was the front door. I got the butcher knife from my knife holder in the kitchen and crouched behind the door. I was waiting for the next time he would pound on the door and I would warn him to go away. I waited for a good minute in silence and finally decided to take a quick look through the window. There was somebody standing in my driveway. I couldn't tell if he was facing me or looking at me or not, but he was surely the one who was pounding on my door at 4 in the morning. He walked away down the sidewalk moments after he must have noticed me. The pounding on my door was the kind of pounding you would expect from someone trying to break in a door, not to get a house owner's attention. I thought it was just crazy and horrifying that the pounding and banging from this potential robber or killer didn't wake me up, rather became the key point to a horrifying dream. I was 19 years old at the time, working at a sketchy motel.
The motel was pretty run down, and the majority of people who stayed there were locals that were just doing things they weren't supposed to be doing. Let's just say the cops came by multiple times a week. I worked as both a front desk person, checking in these creeps all hours of the night, and as a housekeeper who got to clean up their nasty, vomit-smelling rooms afterwards. One afternoon, I was working as a housekeeper in the second building of the motel, on the backside furthest from the office. I hated working over there because it not only had the most worn-down rooms, but it was always pretty vacant over there and way too quiet for comfort. I began cleaning one of my last rooms and wanted to get done in a hurry because it was getting late. I was washing the mirror in the room that I was cleaning when all of a sudden, I saw a man in the reflection staring at me. He was mid-50s, dirty, with long, greasy hair. Startled, I screamed, "Oh my God!" I told him he scared me. The room I was currently cleaning was vacant, so there was no reason why this man should have been in there watching me clean. However, we just had a meeting on customer satisfaction, and my boss was really pressuring us to be more polite and help the guests any way we could. Sir? I asked him cautiously. Can I get you anything? Towels? The man just stared back at me with a crooked grin and held out his hands to me. I thought maybe he was handing me a tip for cleaning his room earlier, but when I looked down, I saw he was holding a $100 bill. Alarm started going off in my head. No one tips $100 on a $40 a night room. The man just smiled and said his name was Terry. He said he was staying in the room next door with his wife Sherry and sort of joked about their names rhyming. He smelled like car oil and alcohol. When I asked him why he was trying to hand me $100, he laughed deep in his throat and said, "Me and my wife were watching you, and we just wanted to have fun with you." I felt like my heart jumped into my throat. No, I can't do that, sir, I'm sorry. I wanted to run out of the room screaming, but he was blocking the door, my only exit. The man smiled again, taking on a softer tone of voice, and invited me to come into his room to meet his wife, just to talk as friends. I nervously told him no again, and that I had a lot of work to do for the day. I prayed to God he would just go away, and eventually he did. He grunted and walked off in what I assumed to be the direction of his room. My mind began racing. There is no wife, I thought. This man could try and kidnap me. I was 110 pounds at the time and not very strong. He could easily overpower me. I locked the room from the inside and went directly to the phone to call my manager at the front desk, but the phone wasn't working. Adrenaline began pumping through my veins, and despite what I was always told not to do, I was panicking. Did he cut the line? No, I thought. This is a crappy motel. It happens all the time. But I just have to get out. I remembered that I had my cell phone out on my housekeeping card, but that was outside the locked door. I'd have to open the door to get it. I cautiously opened the door to the room that I was cleaning and peered out. I didn't see anyone, so I frantically began searching my cart for my cell phone. I was wasting too much time looking for it, so I just decided to run as fast as I could and make a break for the front desk in the office. Then from behind me, I heard the man again, but this time he was screaming to someone else, "She's running, she's getting away." I could hear his shoes slamming against the pavement after me. I quickly turned the corner, grabbed my keycard, and let myself into a stockroom and locked the door. Within moments, I heard the sound of the dirty guy and someone else running outside, searching for me. I stayed in that stockroom for 30 minutes, shaking, until I could no longer hear him searching for me. I finally got the courage to run the rest of the way to the front desk. When I made it there, I collapsed into my boss's arms and he called the police. The man and whoever else was in the room with him peeled out before the cops could arrive, and I was beyond shaken up. According to the police who ran a search, this wasn't the first time he had done something like this, and he was actually wanted for sexual assault, gross sexual imposition, and in the past was once charged with rape. A few weeks later, on what happened to be my birthday, this guy was caught. A few weeks after that, I quit. I will never again work at another motel.
Ever since I can remember, we've always had one of those old vintage Parker Brother Ouija boards sitting in our closet collecting dust. When I was a kid, I always wondered what it was. From the box, it seemed like a horrible board game, until one day I found out what a Ouija board really is, and immediately dug it out of the closet. I insisted on my brother trying it out with me, and eventually got him to play along. We put our hands on the planchette, and I began asking the typical cliche questions like, "Is there anybody there?" and "Can you answer me?" Other than my brother jokingly moving the planchette around to imitate an answer from some kind of entity, there was no real response. After getting bored, we put the game back in the box. I did a little research that night to find out how to make Ouija boards work. Many people said online that the most ideal environment when using a Ouija board is in a dark room only lit by candles. So when my parents weren't home, I managed to gather like 6 or 7 candles and convinced my brother to try it one more time. I lit the candles and set them around the table in the dining room with all the lights out. We tried one more time. I asked again if there was anybody there. The planchette began to move. I told my brother to stop moving it, but he swore he wasn't. I told him to move his hand away, and he did. It kept moving. My brother thought I was messing with him, but I didn't pay attention. The planchette landed on the word, "Yes." I was only 9, so I was legitimately shitting myself. My older brother had to take over. He asked the question, "Are you a good spirit?" There was a 5-second pause before my brother's hand moved along with the planchette to the word, "No." We both looked at each other, and at this point I ran to my room and shut the door behind me, but he continued on with the so-called game. I heard his muffled voice come from down in the dining room, when all of a sudden I heard him screaming at the top of his lungs. I ran back downstairs to see what was wrong. He was holding up his shirt, revealing a small open wound that almost looked like a claw mark. He told me to set the fireplace immediately, and I obeyed. He threw the thing in the fireplace and told me to never speak of what happened to anybody. We have never used a Ouija board since. When I was a kid, my parents would sometimes bring me down to my aunt and uncle's place to stay for the weekend. Mainly, I'd spend time playing with my 2 cousins who were around the same age as me. They lived on a small farm with plenty of open space, and we could run around doing pretty much whatever we wanted. If we thought we could get away with it, the 3 of us would sometimes cross over to the neighboring farm about 1/2 mile away. It had been abandoned for decades, with a scattering of derelict buildings and other structures still standing on the property, just begging to be explored. This was, of course, a gold mine for 3 adventurous young boys such as ourselves, especially after my cousins told me stories about the deaths that took place in the house. It was pretty classic fare. Man goes crazy, axe murders his entire family, hangs himself, returns every night as an angry spirit looking for new victims. Good, grisly stuff. Even at that age, I knew they were probably making it up, or at least embellishing old rumors. But seeing as how the setting lent itself so well to such tales, I allowed myself to buy into it. One afternoon, we decided to play hide and seek. When it was my turn to hide, I ran off for a flimsy brown barn that had living quarters on top, and climbed the stairs looking for a good spot. There was still furniture inside, and personal belongings lay scattered across the floor. I maneuvered over broken dishes, tattered clothes, and crumbling books, eventually coming to a small room with a closet. Jackpot. There were even long black dresses still hanging on the rod that I could hide behind. I stepped inside and managed to force shut the folding door. My only illumination was a slit of sunlight that shone through the crack in the door from a nearby window. I crouched down with knees tucked into chest and waited. Some time passed, and there was still no sign of my seekers. I waited some more, debating if and when I should give myself up. After nearly an hour, this was starting to get boring. My head drooped. I awoke with a jerk. It was pitch black. Drowsy and confused, I forgot for a minute where I was or what I had been doing. As it came back to me,
The realization that it was now nighttime and that I had been abandoned here filled me with sinking dread in the pit of my stomach. I tried to get up, but a sudden cramp in my calf kept me grounded. I squirmed about, waiting for it to pass, when I heard a door slamming shut downstairs and instantly froze. One of my cousins? There was a brief period of silence, then footsteps at the bottom of the stairs. But not just footsteps, a thud too. After every other step. These weren't the footfalls of a child. They were slow, heavy, deliberate. I held my breath, praying they would go away. They did not. The noises continued to ascend. After another moment of silence, the walking resumed, this time along with a steady scraping sound, like something heavy being dragged across the floorboards. The footsteps made their way through the debris and wandered aimlessly through the various rooms. I thought I could smell something faintly putrid. The constant scrape sent cold shivers coursing down my arms and back. My worst fears were realized when the steps reached the bedroom doorway. They got closer and closer and finally stopped directly in front of the closet door. I couldn't see a thing. After an agonizing pause, they continued on, over to the other side of the room and out the doorway again. They faded away down the hallway. I waited for what seemed like an eternity. There were no more sounds now, and I was trying to build up enough courage to open the door and flee. Three things happened simultaneously just then. I was bombarded with a smell I can only describe as fresh roadkill. I heard raspy breathing behind me in the dark closet, and I felt hot breath against the nape of my neck. That was enough for me to hurtle myself out from the confines of that nightmare space, relying on memory and scant moonlight to navigate through the darkened house. All the while, I heard footsteps chasing behind me, closing in with terrifying speed. It was a clumsy, torturous escape, full of trips and bumps and blind stumbling. I never looked back, at least not until I had burst out the front door and into the country night. And when I did turn around, I saw absolutely nothing. There were no more footsteps and nobody was chasing me. That didn't stop me from running, though, all the way back to my aunt and uncle's house. There was a police car in the driveway when I got back. My parents were there too, worried sick. Everybody demanded to know where I had been. Apparently, when my cousins still hadn't found me by evening, they'd returned home to tell their parents. Eventually, the police were called in and informed me that they had already scoured every building on the farm. The insinuation that I was lying about my whereabouts didn't go unnoticed. None of it made any sense. It wasn't until years later that one of my cousins filled in a final piece of the story. He and his brothers had spent hours searching for me, like they said. But the part they didn't tell anyone was that they thought they spotted me in the window of the bedroom I was hiding in. And when they got closer, they saw that it wasn't me. A young boy neither of them recognized was smiling and waving down at them and gesturing for them to come upstairs. That's when they ran back home. All of this while I slept in the closet. This story took place about 5 years ago on Christmas Eve night. It was around 1 a.m, and I had just finished placing presents under the tree. I went upstairs to brush up and everything, then came back downstairs to the kitchen to get a glass of water before bed. My son Jake, who was 4 at the time, was standing by the stairs leading to the basement. I asked him what he was doing up so late. He pointed down the stairs and said, "Santa." I picked him up and carried him back to his room. I took a glass of water and went to bed. I woke up around an hour later to my son running down the hall outside my room. I sighed and got out of bed. As I was going down the stairs, I saw Jake by the tree looking at presents. Then he ran past me and to the basement stairs again. He pointed down the stairs again. This time I looked down the stairwell, and my heart dropped as I saw a black figure sitting on the bottom step. I almost screamed, but I somehow held it in. I pulled my son quietly away from the basement door and closer to the front door of the house. I moved my hand away from my son's mouth to reach for the lock on the doorknob. I tried to pull the door open as quietly as possible, but it was pointless. The squeaky hinges let out the usual ear-piercing screeches, and I cringed my mouth and eyes as I did. Suddenly, there were heavy stomps coming from up the basement stairs. I screamed and pushed open the storm door and practically threw Jake outside. I shut both doors behind us and we ran to the neighbor's house. I rang the doorbell as fast as possible, probably 30 times before they answered. After that, we went inside and stayed there and waited for the police. Whoever that person was gone though, as determined after the police conducted a thorough investigation of the house. I ended up lying to Jake, telling him that actually was Santa Claus, but a few years later, he remembered the incident and became a little more wise to what actually happened.
One late night, I was walking along the path with my friend. Suddenly, I heard someone from behind us speaking quietly. Don't look back. Don't look back. If you look back, if you do that. I stopped in amazement. There was silence for a few seconds. And behind me, I could hear something ripping. And a groan of pain that I don't know whether it was an animal or a human. Being seized with fear, I clenched my teeth to stop my instinctive curiosity to look back. However, when I took a peek at my friend Ken, he who seemed couldn't resist curiosity, has been already looked back. Ken, who thought someone was fooling around, was smiling and looking around to see who it was. Although we couldn't see around it because it was dark already, he seemed to think it was no big deal. Just then, I heard someone scream. If you look back, you are going to die! Something flew in and stuck in Ken's body. And a moment later, he fell to the ground groaning. The knife was stuck in his leg when I looked at him in extreme fear. He screamed and shouted, don't look back! Run! I grabbed his arm and ran away like crazy. I heard a chasing sound from behind, but didn't have the courage to look back though. I'm starving! Give it to me! The man shouted, and when I glanced back, I could see him laughing, bleeding from his mouth, and following us like a mad, holding a knife in his hand. Ken, who was limping at that moment, was soon caught by him. To my surprise, he grabbed Ken's leg and tried to cut out the flesh with a knife. It was like he was cutting steak something. I kicked him as hard as I could, and he was eventually knocked out. We barely managed to escape and were able to get away from him. We hid somewhere and ended up calling the police. Soon, there was the sound of a police car. I took a look at Ken's condition, and his leg's flesh was torn apart. When I asked him what had happened, Ken then replied in pain. The moment Ken looked back, he saw a homeless man who was eating something alive raw. And that man threw the knife he was holding at Ken when he met his eyes. The police later arrested him and also found a man whose flesh had been torn apart from his entire body. It turned out that man was eaten alive. Barely breathing, he eventually died on his way to the emergency room. The victim, who was drunk, fell unconscious on the floor at the time and was eaten by a homeless man. I still can't forget Ken's deathly pale face. If I had failed to run away that day, I might be lost some part of my body too.
It was a dark, scary Halloween night in 2020. There were many kids having a fun trick-or-treating and the adults were giving out their candies.
There was a group of kids who stood out whose names were Bob, Jimmy, Nick, Cameron, and Clyde. They were out all night trying to get as much candy as they could get. After they were done, they went to a bench and started eating and trading their candy. They then started to feel bored. There was nothing to do for the rest of the night. Jimmy had an idea.
Guys, let's go explore the abandoned hospital down the road. I've heard it's super scary, and there's a clown inside, he said.
The rest of the group agreed to go. It was around 11 p.m. when they got there. The hospital was gigantic, with it being around 20 floors tall, and was wide. As the only girl in the group, Cameron said she was way too scared to go to the hospital. She ended up running back home. There were only four. When they went in, they could smell the dead bodies of rats and the mold that was growing in. You could see all the equipment still there and the bed scattered everywhere, with blood on the floor. After walking around for a bit, the whole group noticed that they saw something running behind them every couple of minutes. However, they didn't have any clue what it was. Then, they heard a voice telling them to get out multiple times. A couple of minutes later, they heard a piercing scream. The group looked around and realized that Clyde had disappeared. That's when it got serious. They were terrified and wanted to leave, but the doors latched shut from the outside and they were on the 12th floor.
I think it's the one, the clown! Clyde! Clyde, where are you?
Teary-eyed, Jimmy started yelling for Clyde. They soon accepted their situation and gave up. Nick went into one of the rooms and found many used syringes that they used to draw blood in. They took some, split up, and went to defend themselves. Since Bob was the one who was scared of little things, he just closed his eyes and swung his arm with the syringe. Jimmy, on the other hand, wanted to hunt down that clown and save their friend Clyde. Nick was just wandering around the hospital trying to find a fire escape, and there he was. About 12 feet away from him, the clown was standing there. He screamed,
"Get out of my hospital!"
However, instead of running away, Nick ran towards the clown as fast as he could, slid in between his legs, stabbed his back with the syringe, and finally ran out of the exit. He managed to unlatch the door and yelled for his friends to come back down, and the rest of them also succeeded in escaping.
"I'm going inside again. I have to save Clyde."
When Nick told his friends, everyone tried to stop him, but he rushed inside. While he was going up the stairs, he found a baseball bat and grabbed it. After more walking, he found the clown in front of him limping.
"What did you do to my friend, you bastard?"
he yelled, but the clown just laughed like he was insane. Just then, he heard someone saying, "Help me," with a small voice. This time, he hit the clown right in the mouth with the baseball bat and ran towards the voice. He found Clyde locked in a room.
"Let's get the hell out of here."
They started to run down another fire exit. When they were halfway there, they heard heavy footsteps above them. They all knew who it was. They gave it everything they got. They ran down the stairs as fast as they could and escaped from the hospital. While Nick and his friends were running away to the police station, they reported that they saw a clown in the abandoned hospital. To their surprise, when the police arrived at the hospital and checked inside, there was no one in there. The clown was never to be seen again. I've been in between jobs ever since I left college, doing different things here and there, odd jobs sometimes. It wasn't until I started as a 911 operator that I realized that's what I really wanted to do with my life. But it had only been about 4 months when I received one of the most chilling, unexplainable, and spine-tingling phone calls of my life. The night it happened was a particularly grueling shift. I'd spent the last 10 hours dispatching police for the various houses. I was about 2 hours from finishing when I received a call from a little girl named Samantha. The following is a transcript of that call.
911 operator, what's your emergency?
Hello, mommy's fallen over.
What's your name, honey?
Samantha.
Okay, Samantha, can you tell me where you live?
I don't know the address. Can you find me?
Yes, Samantha, I can trace the call. Can you tell me what happened? Mommy's been acting all weird the past few days. Not sleeping at nights. Going around scratching at the walls. I'm too scared to come out of my room. I was in bed and I started hearing this weird moaning sound. Mommy sounded like a zombie. And that's when I heard someone giggle. What's Mommy doing right now, Samantha? Mommy's on the floor right now. She won't get up.
Is she breathing?
I don't know. I can't see her chest moving. I'm scared. It's okay, honey. Help is on the way. I'll need you to stay on the line until they arrive. Can you do that?
Yes. Something's happening. What's happening?
Mommy's twitching now. Her eyes are fluttering. That's when I hear the distinct sounds of someone moaning and the sounds of someone dragging something. I could hear Samantha's whimpering.
Is someone coming? I'm scared.
Yes, Samantha. They're not far away. What are those noises?
It's Mommy.
Samantha, what's Mommy doing? I'm hiding in my wardrobe. She's crawling on the floor like a tarantula. Her eyes have gone all weird. She's hissing and this weird foamy stuff is coming out of her mouth.
Can she see you?
I don't think she can see me yet. Is someone coming? Are they close? Yes, very close. Just then, I heard Samantha whisper something.
Samantha, are you okay?
Mommy's walking backwards now. I think she knows where I am. Her black eyes are looking right at me. Please, I'm scared. Mommy's trying to hurt me.
Samantha, what do you mean your mommy's walking backwards?
It's all upside down. Her legs are twisted the wrong way. Her body is normal, but her head is all backwards too. Do you know when you twist your Barbie's head? It's like that. She's shaking as she walks, kind of like a robot. She's coming!
Samantha, the police are right around the corner.
Mommy's smiling now. I think it's okay for me to come out.
Samantha, stay where you are.
Mommy?
Samantha? Samantha, the police are right outside.
Mommy, please stop. You're scaring me.
Samantha? Samantha?
I don't want to eat that, Mommy.
What do you mean it'll make me just like you? Where are we going, Mommy?
Just then, I heard a piercing scream, and the line went dead. When the police finally arrived at the scene, they neither found Samantha nor her mother. In fact, the house didn't look like someone had ever lived in it. They reported that the lights didn't work at all. There was no furniture, and they found the decaying corpse of a dog which looked to have been dead for weeks in the middle of the living room. Insects, maggots, all kinds of detestable things were found slithering around the house, but not a trace of any living human being. Eventually, I quit my job the very next morning. That call has haunted me ever since then. I just couldn't comprehend my experience. My boss and the other officers were all adamant that they were sent to the wrong address. It was all deemed the fault of the dispatcher, me. But I know I wasn't wrong. I know the address was right, and I know there was no error in the system. It wasn't my fault. I think about Samantha every day, and I pray that nothing bad happened to her. However, deep in my heart, I know that someone was pretending to be her mother, and that someone did something unspeakable to her, something unthinkable. I will never forget that scream.
This is a disturbing story that happened to me about 4 years ago. It was around December. The snowstorms were starting to come in, and it was becoming very cold. Me and my wife were trying to get everything we could before winter started, mainly food and supplies. The problem was is that we didn't have a car. We couldn't afford it. I worked a low-wage job, and was making enough to barely pay rent on our shitty old apartment. My wife usually stayed home and took care of our two-month-old baby, and I was doing the best I could to save enough money for a car. And finally, after months of saving, I had enough. One day I came home and told my wife the good news, and she was relieved. The next day we went to our local car dealership. There was only two cars on the lot, and they weren't the greatest, but the prices were very low, and as long as it got us from point A to point B, we would be happy. So we did what we needed to, paid for it, got the keys, and drove off. The car was from 1984 and was pretty run down, but it drove just fine. 6 months later, I was cleaning out the car when I noticed something odd under the back seat. It was something that I had never seen before. Despite having checked the car multiple times at this point, I looked closer, but I would need a flashlight in order to see it clearly. It looked like a black box of some kind. I thought it was just something the previous owner had left behind. Finally, curiosity got the best of me, and I pulled it out of the car. It was an old VHS tape, marked Happy Memories. It looked to be around the same age as the car. I didn't know what to do with it. I just thought it was some old home video from the previous owner, although it was pretty strange that it was hiding underneath the seat. While I didn't want to invade anyone's privacy, I decided that I wanted to see what was on the tape to satisfy my curiosity. I went up to my attic and found my old VHS player. I hadn't used it since high school, back when I threw parties and me and my buddies would watch movies on it. It was a bit dusty, but it still worked just fine. I turned it on and put in the tape. It started off pretty normal. It was a family during Christmas, people walking around, opening gifts, etc. Then things got a little uncomfortable. The husband and wife began arguing while the children were crying in the background. The argument got more and more intense as it went on. I could not make out exactly what was being said. The camera cut off, and the screen was black, before cutting back into a scene that was so fucked up that it kept me up for weeks after. I will never get this image out of my head. The camera was now set up in a dark room. There was torture weapons hanging from the walls, and dismembered body parts scattered across the floor. The same wife and children from the beginning were now on their knees chained together and sobbing. That's about as much detail as I'm willing to go into. There was also a man in the room, whose face was cut off from the camera's view. The man stepped out of frame and switched off the overhead light. And what he said next won't stop repeating in my head. I guess this is a happy memory for someone like me. After that, all that was heard was the horrified screams of the family. I had to turn off the tape. I couldn't take it anymore. I took the tape out and just stared at it for what seemed like hours. The images of the bodies, all the blood, the terrified faces of the family were now burnt into my mind. It was hours before I said a single word to anyone. I eventually called the police and explained what I had found. After weeks of investigation, they found out that this tape was of a family who had gone missing 32 years ago. They said that their house was demolished in 2003, and a car dealership was built in its place, the exact same place where I got the car. That's when it hit me. Thinking back, the car salesman looked a lot like the husband from the beginning of the video, except a lot older. Now that I think about it, he was kind of in a hurry to get us out of there after we bought the car, shortly after the shop was closed down, and is now abandoned. A lot of my friends went there over the years and said it was a really good place for a cheap car. I would pass it every day driving to work. I'm assuming the police followed up on all of this during their investigation, but I never heard of any arrests being made or further updates on the case. As far as I know, that man is still out there.
My name is Skylar, and this happened to me when I was 12. It was a Saturday afternoon. My cousins were staying with my family over the weekend. My parents had to head over to the store, and my cousins and I decided to go to the nearby park to play. Before we left, we made sure the door was locked like we were supposed to. However, by the time we came back, I could see the door was open. There were even scratch marks on the handle, as if someone had tried to pick the lock by force. My older cousin Sam called my parents, and they said they were on their way. Stupidly, we thought the intruder had left already, so we ended up going into the house. That was a mistake. My younger cousin, who was 9 years old at the time, had to go to the bathroom, but when he stepped out, his face was frozen with fear. We asked him what happened, but he couldn't speak at all, just pointed at the bathroom. I slowly opened the door. and what I saw made my heart drop. A blood-soaked man was dead in the bathtub. I checked if he was breathing, but couldn't feel anything. It looked as if someone had attacked him. My cousins and I started panicking, realizing that there must be a second intruder somewhere in the house. We cowered together in the living room and waited for my parents. When they finally arrived, they called the police right away. During their investigation, they found out that those two men had escaped from a mental hospital nearby. It turned out that they were both trying to rob my house when one of the men lost his mind and ended up killing the other. From that day on, my parents never dared leave me home alone. I always double-check the door before I leave. Now, I'm 15 years old, and my family has moved to Florida. However, I don't think I will ever forget the memory of that dead man in our bathtub. My name is Alexa, and this happened a month ago while I was having a sleepover at my friend's house. I'm going to call her Kate. Kate is 3 years older than me. I'm 11. We were in Kate's room when her mother told us that she had to head over to the hospital. She said, "Girls, close the windows and lock all the doors, okay?" After she left, we went to the living room to play with Kate's dog. About an hour passed and we got kind of bored. So we ended up going out and heading to a 7-Eleven to get some snacks and chips. When we got back, I noticed that the door was just slightly open. Kate noticed it too. We were confused. Had we really left it open like that? We ended up just shrugging it off and going inside. Kate locked the door behind us. When we got up to her room, Kate's dog was there, barking at her closet. "Stop," Kate told her, but she kept barking relentlessly. Just then, though, I suddenly remembered the closet door had been wide open when we left. I was puzzled and started to feel a little scared at the same time. I slowly grabbed her baseball bat and swung open the closet door. What I saw inside was a clown with horrific makeup and a costume. And then I saw the knife in his hand. As soon as he saw me, he tried to stand up, but I started to swing the bat over and over, screaming. I couldn't stop even while Kate was calling the police. Just before he passed out, I could definitely hear him say, "Y'all can't escape. There are more of us out there." When the police finally arrived, we told them everything. While the clown was dragged out of the house, he kept staring and grinning at me. He smiled, and what he told me still creeped me out.
This happened to my father one stormy night in Glenwood, Colorado. It was the 1980s. My father was an electrical engineer who was just returning from a job site. He worked long hours, and it wasn't uncommon for him to be heading home around midnight to the small cabin he shared with a friend tucked back in the canyon walls. It was pouring rain. Lightning flashed only to illuminate the murky puddled patches of washed out terrain. As my father rounded the corner upon the dirt road, he passed a large willow tree. As his headlights crossed its base, he noticed someone was crouched underneath it. It was a woman who seemed to be in her late 20s, with long tangled blonde hair. She had on fairly casual clothing, and carried a somewhat large bundle under her arms wrapped in cloth. My father, being the gentleman that he was, decided to pull over and offered her to take shelter from the storm in his cabin, just up the road. She smiled and thanked him. As she got into his vehicle, she explained that she had been on a hike through the canyon that day when the storm hit, and she had been caught off guard by the rain. Dad smiled and pointed out that she wasn't exactly wearing the best clothing or shoes to go on a hike. She laughed and said that she had left her place on a whim unprepared. He asked if she needed him to dry anything at his place, pointing to the bundle she held tightly under her arm. Her voice suddenly got very stern and stated no. When my father asked her where she lived around the area, things started to get strange. She started telling my dad that she had no friends or family in the area and was quite vague when asked about details of where she lived. All she responded with was that it was too far to drive to tonight in this kind of weather. At this point, my dad said he felt that she was a bit off, but chalked it up to her exhaustion from hiking and standing out in the storm for several hours. As they entered the cabin, my dad remembered that his roommate had left that morning to take a trip out of town and wouldn't be back for several days. My dad would have offered her his friend's room, but wouldn't feel comfortable doing that without her permission. Remember, this was the 1980s. Pocket cell phones weren't on everyone yet. My dad told her that she was welcome to sleep on the couch and dry off as he handed her several towels. She took them from him with her right hand, but still never let go of the bundle she hugged under her left arm. My dad at this point realized that she had never given him her name, so he introduced himself. "Nice to meet you. My name is Mary Lou," she replied. My father started to feel a bit more at ease and turned on the television for her and handed over the remote. She scanned through the channels, finally deciding on a gangster flick. There was a scene that involved a bunch of mobsters getting shot to pieces. Mary found this to be quite amusing and started to laugh in a crackling, high-pitched tone. My dad started to get a bit creeped out by this. She was enjoying it a little too much, he said. Then my dad asked her about her life, and things took a turn for the worse. When asked if she was in a relationship, she pointed down at her belt buckle and told my dad the story of her breakup. She claimed her last boyfriend wanted to be domineering over her, and to this she responded by bludgeoning him half to death in his gravel driveway with her belt buckle, the same one she was wearing. He kept saying, "Stop, please stop," and begging, but I wouldn't show him mercy, she said, with a note of pride in her voice. My dad asked if he had been abusing her, or if she was reacting defensively, and she merely scoffed and said, "No, otherwise he would be dead." My father's unease grew as the conversations progressed. She told him about her mother dying on the operating table, and how the surgeon who had been working on her walked out covered in blood and said that she would be fine. "How is she supposed to be okay with all of her guts in the trash can?" she spewed. Then she laughed again, glancing back at the TV screen, littered with disheveled, bullet-ridden corpses. "I love the sight of blood. It excites me. Turns me on, you know. Death. Draining them to death." At this point, my dad was officially done. He was bigger and stronger than she was, and he was quite streetwise as well, and had seen plenty of horrors in his life. But the way she spoke, with a violent confidence, combined with her sure grip upon the bundle which lay under her arm, sent chills down his spine. He needed a plan. Finally, an idea popped into my father's head. "I have a friend who's a priest in town. He has access to plenty of shelters funded by the church. You would be a lot more comfortable there instead of on our couch. They can feed you too, and arrange a ride for you to get home in the morning. I can call him right now. He's only a few miles from here," he stated reassuringly. Mary Lou's tone brightened to match his. "That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much." My father smiled, hiding his relief. "Of course, it's the least I could do for you." As my dad walked over to the phone and began to dial the number, Mary Lou erupted in a low guttural growl. "I hate priests. I hate priests." She said it with a tired hatred, a clear, distinct, audible, whispered disdain from the bottom of her heart with an unflinching resolve. My dad had enough. This wasn't a game to play anymore. This was beyond a stranger with odd tendencies. A darkness with coiled cruelty had crossed the threshold of his door. "You need to leave, and you need to leave now," my dad said, pointing to the front of the cabin. "There's the door. I can't have you here and feel comfortable. I'm sorry, but the storm has stopped, and I hate to have you walk in the dark, but that's the way this has to go. Please leave." Mary Lou gazed upon him, expressionless, and finally just shrugged. My father walked her out, standing close to her, in the event that the bundle concealed some type of weapon. He wasn't taking any chances. She smiled at him as she slowly walked onto the front porch. "Goodbye for now. I'll see you when I see you," she said calmly. With that, she walked down the long dirt road with a single streetlight upon its path. She looked back at him one last time before crossing the light and disappearing, enveloped by the darkness with no trace of her to be seen. My dad called the police the next day, concerned that she may still be hiding on his premises somewhere. After speaking to his girlfriend about it, who is now my mom, and being convinced by her that she was going to cut the window screen when he was gone, hide in the house, and then kill him. They found nothing, and said the area attracted a lot of transients and nomads. My father then made the mistake of telling his engineer buddies at work, which resulted in them bidding him farewell at the end of each shift, in the form of asking that he say hi to Mary Lou for them. My dad never saw her again. He still questions what could have been in that bundle that she so adamantly protected. He will never know.
This tragic incident happened 3 years ago. I need to explain my family first to help you understand my story. I used to live with my dad, mom, and older brother. Since I was young, my dad always fought with my mom, so my brother and I always spent the night shivering in fear. My mom was full of bruises and scars from being beaten by dad, and there were many times when her life was almost in danger. 3 years ago, it was when I was 17. Being a grown-up, we were already used to Dad's violence. Whenever he got violent, I screamed and threw myself to stop him, but it didn't always stop so easily. My brother would just quietly get out of the house. I understood him. There was really no way to stop our dad. It was the same day as usual. That night as well, my dad threw liquor bottles and cursed at us. He wielded the knife like he was really going to kill us, and my mom got cut and bled while protecting us. I was crying with fear. Then someone knocked on the door outside.
"Piss off, you son of a bitch!"
my dad shouted. However, the knocking continued. My dad ended up opening the door in anger. To our surprise, a man in a clown costume and mask stood outside. My dad yelled and cursed at the man to get away, but the clown stood there still.
"Who the fuck are you?"
My dad cursed at him for a long time and turned around. Just then, the moment he turned around, the clown hit his head with a hammer from behind. Dad fell down on the floor and ended up dead while convulsing. And then I heard a sobbing sound. The clown was sobbing, shaking his shoulders like crazy, and walked away. After a while, the police who received the report rushed to the scene and quickly caught the clown. And the moment they unmasked the clown, I collapsed to the floor. I was in a breathtaking shock on the spot. It was my brother. Although tears were flowing from his eyes, I could see he was smiling. He kept muttering as he was arrested by the police.
"It's all over now. It's all right. It's all right."
To this day, I am unable to forget about that day. I just live in the nightmare. But I never blame him at all. He just wanted to end this hell.
My name is Flora, and I'm going to tell you a story about what happened to me 2 years ago. It was my senior year of high school. Everything was going well, and my school results were decent. I got along with my classmates and often talked to everyone. Well, everyone except this one boy who always kept to himself. He was just always drawing quietly in his seat at the back of the class. Everyone took his behavior for shyness, and no one usually talked to him. In fact, I was one of the few who had tried to make him come out of his shell, but he just royally ignored me. For a while, I gave up on the idea of dragging him out of his fortress of loneliness figuring that he must just have preferred his own company. Then one time, I ran into him in the hall, where he was sitting, and of course drawing into his sketchbook. I decided to give it one more try. "Hi, what are you drawing?" I asked him. As usual, he didn't answer to me, or even acknowledge my presence. He just kept drawing with a blank expression on his face, calm and emotionless. After waiting a while, I ended up leaving him alone. A few days later, I spotted him at the metro station on my way home. The station was pretty empty. There were three people there. Me, a man probably in his 40s sitting cross-legged on a bench with his little briefcase, and my mysterious classmate carrying a big sports bag. This time, I chose to not try and talk to him. I didn't feel like getting ignored once again. When the metro arrived, we all got on the same car. What struck me immediately was the stench. Not the smell of sweat or anything. It was more like rotten meat. It's a smell I will never forget. The expression on the 40-year-old man's face clearly indicated surprise and disgust. So I concluded the source of the smell had to be my classmate, or rather his gym bag. I wanted to get a little bit further, to put some distance between myself and his smelly bag, as quickly as possible. Suddenly the man in the suit said something that stopped me in my tracks though. "Young man, what is that dripping from your bag?" Small red drops were beading on the base of the bag before falling to the ground, gradually creating a puddle. I started to break out in cold sweat, but had no idea how to react. My classmate remained silent, ignoring us both, just as he always ignored me. No one spoke again until the ticket inspector stepped into our car to check our tickets. He also noticed the puddle of red under the bag and hurried to remind my classmate that food was prohibited on the metro.
"You're going to have to open your bag," he said.
My classmate hesitated, but then slowly began to open the front pocket of the bag. And before any one of us could react to it, he started brandishing a big kitchen knife in our direction, still in complete silence. Luckily, the inspector and the middle-aged man managed to disarm and subdue him quickly. They then asked me to call the police and tell the driver, which, of course, I quickly did. About 10 or 15 minutes later, the police arrived at the next station, where we were waiting. They took my statement and opened his bag. Inside, there were two human hands covered in blood. It was horrible. The image is still imprinted in my memory to this day. Later, I learned that my classmate had severe psychological problems, and he continuously drew hands in his sketchbook. I still visit a psychologist, trying to forget about this incident, to not think that I could have lost my hands, or worse, and above all, to forget that this boy was my classmate.
During the late 90s, I was at a very low point in my life. I was a drug addict wandering the streets of downtown Los Angeles, eating out of trash cans, sleeping under bridges, and asking random bypassers for spare change. Looking back, I have nothing but regret for that time in my life, but this story is about the incident that made me sober up and turn my life around. One night, I was sleeping under a secluded highway overpass. It was fairly isolated because of its location on the outskirts of the city, and saw little to no police presence. My sleeping spot overlooked a concrete foundation that had stretched on for about 50 yards. It was a pretty long walk to get back to the city from this area, so after a long day of panhandling, I slipped into my sleeping bag and began to doze off. I was suddenly woken up by the sounds of screaming. I turned on my side to see a car parked under the overpass. There were no lights on, but the vehicle's windows were down, and I could tell that there was a commotion taking place inside the cab. Now, I know what you might be thinking. At first, I thought the same thing too. Maybe someone was getting lucky, but these were not screams of pleasure. They were screams of agony. I watched in horror as the passenger side door of the car then flung open, and a skimpily dressed woman exited the car. She was holding her leg and was trying her best to limp away from the car. I was frozen in place, almost not believing what I was witnessing. The girl was begging for her life as she awkwardly staggered away from the vehicle. The driver's side door then opened, and a figure emerged from the car. The person that emerged from the car then pointed a gun at the girl, then shot her. I remember closing my eyes as soon as the gun went off, and then opening them to see the woman sprawled out on the ground. She was on her back, and the way her head was positioned was as if she was looking at me. Her jaw was going up and down like she was trying to say something. The memory of seeing her like that, well, it still really haunts me. The shooter made his way over to her. When he stepped into the light, I could see that he was wearing a dark hooded jacket with a bandana hiding his face. He stood over her and just watched her for several seconds, then finishing her off with the second shot. I was absolutely petrified at what I had just witnessed. I was now sitting up in my sleeping bag with one hand over my mouth, just trying my best to not make a sound. But what happened next was a whole new level of fucked up. The headlights of another vehicle at the opposite end of the overpass flicked on and drove up to the gruesome scene. At first I was relieved and I stupidly thought that these people were there to help, not even factoring in that a bystander wouldn't just casually drive up to the scene of a crime with a killer still there with a loaded gun. But things became clear to me once I noticed that the other vehicle was a black van. And things became even more clear once I saw three men wearing ski masks exiting the van, with one of them holding a video camera. These sick fucks were filming this entire thing. There was an exchange of words, and the other two men that exited the van walked over to the dead woman and grabbed her arms and legs, then proceeded to carry her body back to the car. The shooter had made his way over to the car before they got there, and the cameraman sat off to the side and filmed the entire thing. The shooter popped open the trunk, and the men heaved the corpse into it. The cameraman then joined them at the car for a nice close-up shot. The shooter then walked over to the van, then returned with two gas cans. The men doused the car in gasoline, and the shooter struck a match and threw it, and the car was instantly engulfed in flames. The foreman and myself watched as the car burned. As I stared into the fire, I became numb. I had apparently reached my scare limit, and now was just angry. Angry at these animals for what they had done. Even if the woman was an addict or a hooker, no one deserves to die like that, murdered under an overpass in cold blood. The fact that there were others there filming the whole thing pissed me off even more. The four men eventually bobbed back into the van, then left. A short while later, I had emerged from the overpass and made my way to the nearest payphone to call the police. I don't think the police took me seriously at first, until I led them to the burning car. I was questioned for hours by detectives, and yes, they did suspect me, a homeless junkie of foul play, but I stuck to my story. They did keep me in a holding cell for a few days, which they probably couldn't legally do, but I honestly didn't really mind at all. Free showers and food. I was actually a bit bummed out when they eventually released me. I later found out that there were similar killings in San Francisco and Sacramento, and that the perpetrators were wanted by the FBI. I don't know for sure if they ever caught them. I only hope that they did. After that night, I decided that I had enough of living on the streets. The fear I experienced inspired me to get my shit together, finish college, and become an English teacher. I'm proud to say that I've been sober for over 23 years. Sometimes seeing the ugliest side of humanity, well, I think that's the cure.
This happened to myself and a friend of mine. We're both 23-year-old males. We decided to go on a two-night backpacking camping trip to the Adirondack Mountains of New York. We are both very comfortable with nature, and spend a lot of time outside hunting, camping, and fishing. We hiked about 5 miles to get to a small lake so we could set up camp on the beach. We didn't really expect to run into anyone else. Our first night there, as we were sitting around the fire, we saw a flashlight moving on the other side of the lake around 10:30. This was fairly unusual. However, we did not think much of it. But as time went on, this flashlight kept moving around the lake, getting closer to our campsite. We kept discussing who could possibly be wandering around the woods in the middle of the night. We did not want to deal with any unwelcomed guests. Once it was clear that the person, or people, were heading for our campsite, we moved off into the nearby woods to see who wandered up. I took a small axe with me and my friend had a .22 rifle. Now, we weren't expecting any trouble, and we certainly didn't want to make any, but we figured we might as well cover our bases. Now, the moment of truth. The flashlight comes near the light of our fire, and it's one man. He has a beard and was probably in his mid-40s. The scary part was that he was carrying what turned out to be a pump-action shotgun. He walked around our campsite a few times, and then proceeded to enter our tent. After rummaging around for about a minute, he came out and started yelling,
"I know you're out there. Why don't you come and say hello?"
My friend and I remained motionless under a hemlock tree about 50 yards away. That's when the man proceeded to fire his shotgun into the woods, not too far from where we were. He also swung his flashlight around several times. After what felt like hours, he grabbed my friend's backpack and a few articles of clothing that we had drying near the fire and threw them in to burn. My friend had the .22 rifle trained at the man. He asked me if he should shoot. I told him absolutely not, unless he spots us and starts pointing the gun in our direction. Thankfully, the man moved off after a while. We waited until his flashlight was on the other side of the lake. Then we ran out and grabbed everything we could fit in my pack and took off. It was now 2 or 3 a.m. We ran out the trail with our flashlights and made it back to my car as the sun was coming up. We immediately went to the police department and reported it, where we also spoke with some forest rangers. And that was it. I still haven't heard anything back from the police, and this experience creeped the hell out of both of us. I used to live in this small, sleepy forest town, which at the time was notorious for being the most boring place to raise a family in the Midwest. That never bothered me very much. I liked the isolation and the privacy, and the knowledge that those late-breaking violent stories you hear on the news would never involve us. I lived about a minute away from a large open field, where I could easily walk for about 15 minutes without ever having to set foot on concrete. One day last summer, I was taking my dog Oscar for a walk across the field pretty early in the morning as I usually did. But today, something happened to catch my eye immediately after I went through the fence. About 15 meters to the left of the entry gate is an old fishing pit that was surrounded by overgrown bushes with barbed wire. So I heard something rustling from the undergrowth, and I stopped to investigate. I noticed the outline of someone standing under the shadows of the trees, staring at me without moving. Completely taken aback and slightly unnerved, I decided to just keep walking my dog as if I hadn't seen anything. I usually play music on my phone, but after that chilling encounter, I had no intention of doing so, just in case that person decided to try and come at me from behind. After walking for another 15 minutes, I completed my loop around the field and was making my way back, when I noticed a tall man walking from the grassy area around the fishing pit to the gate. It was hard to tell because of the distance, but I would say he was around 30 years old and well built. I made sure to keep my distance and decided to play fetch with my dog for a while and give him time to leave, as my gut feeling was telling me that it wasn't a good idea to approach him. After a short while, I made sure the coast was clear and called my dog back over to me and reattached his leash. As we were making our way out of the field through the gate where we originally entered, Oscar started pulling at his leash and sniffing around the bushes where I had first noticed the silhouette of the man. I tugged at the leash and called my dog's name, but he refused to obey, which was strange because he usually didn't give me any trouble. I walked towards him to grab his collar, nervously scanning the area again for the strange man, when I noticed a piece of blue cloth on the other side of the barbed wire divider that surrounds the fishing pit. I tied my dog to a nearby stump, carefully climbed over the fence, and went to investigate. This next part is very difficult for me to recount, because while a part of me is pleased my actions that day brought light to a violent crime and brought closure, however horrific, to someone's family, another part of me wishes I had just been less patient and kept tugging at my dog, because the nightmares have yet to stop. There was a body of a young girl covered in bruises all over her face and lacerations to her wrists. Fresh blood was pooling under the gash in her neck. Her eyes were all puffy, like she had been crying for a very long time. I couldn't even begin to imagine what she had been put through. After calling the police, I sat by the gate and waited what was probably only about 8 minutes, but it felt like a lifetime. Even though I obviously knew she was dead, when I overheard the ambulance attendant confirm it, I threw up all over the grass. The police tried asking me questions, and I told them what I could recall about the stranger, while my dog whined and tried to nuzzle me while I sat on the grass. A week later, I read in the newspaper that the young girl was a 12-year-old named Megan that had gone missing no more than 5 minutes away from my house. She had been sexually assaulted before being murdered. After 3 months of continuous searching, nobody matched the vague description of the man I had given the police. More than a few times, I've noticed people in my own town giving me sideways glances that feel more like suspicion than pity, and that's almost more than I can bear. Please just remember to keep things in perspective, no matter how shitty a day you're having. However many trivial inconveniences you have to endure, you were at least lucky enough not to have found a dead child while enjoying your daily routine. My thoughts and prayers go out to that poor girl's family.
This story is about my ex-girlfriend. She was a lovely woman whom I met about 5 years ago when I was 20 years old. I loved her with all my heart. However, I was getting tired of her growing obsession and violent behavior. I realized that her mental age was lower than the average person's, and whenever she got angry, she cursed me with what she called a magic wand. I then had to pretend to be under her spell and suffer from it. I couldn't stand it, so I broke up with her. She didn't take it well and started stalking me for almost a year. "I will dedicate your soul to the devil," she cursed me with these words. And since then, there has always been a dead body of a mouse or a cat in front of my house. Eventually, I blocked all contact and managed to escape from her. However, she eventually showed up in front of me 5 years later. We ran into each other at a friend's party, and she greeted me with a familiar, lovely face. Seeing that, I felt like I had forgotten all of my past wounds. It was nice to see her rather than hate her. It almost seemed as if nothing had happened. Then she suddenly asked me to have dinner sometime. At first, I wanted to say no, but then decided to accept her offer as I thought it would be okay to just have dinner with her. Surprisingly, she was very kind and didn't show any violent tendencies like in the past. We had a great time at the restaurant, and after the meal, she suggested going to her house for another drink. I accepted the offer as my caution against her had been lifted. However, I was surprised to see the state of her house when I arrived. The floor was littered with trash and dolls as if it hadn't been cleaned for months, and there was this unknown stench from somewhere hitting my nose. But she acted so casually that I, who was freaked out at the moment, pretended that everything was fine. Then, there was one thing that caught my eye. Through the slightly open door of her room, I could see an awl stuck through a doll. I was horrified for a moment, but tried not to show my fear. While she brought us a drink and we drank...
That's to be continued. So... Anyway, I hope y'all enjoyed the show. I always enjoy entertaining y'all each time I grace the airwaves. So make sure y'all join me tomorrow, same time, same place, for night 2 of the 31 Days of Horror. I also want to say this before I get off. I got a couple of inboxes about the show. I'm glad y'all enjoyed it, but it's one in particular inbox that I got on Instagram that was quite disturbing or whatever. And let me say this. This is pure entertainment. I never once said that I was going to be telling those stories because, for one, I am a poet. Hence, therefore, Raven the Serial Poet. Not Raven the Serial Poet Storyteller or whatever the case may be, but, you know, Raven the Serial Poet. So if you can't take the show for what it is, pure entertainment, trust and believe, you don't have to listen. You will not be missed. I don't want to come off as ungrateful, but yeah, I have a lot of people that enjoy the shows. They may not call in or listen right now or listen when I'm live, but they always go back and listen to the playback. So if you don't like it, don't listen. It's that simple. But I'm going to get out of here. But before I do, y'all know I always do my thought of the night. And my thought of the night is this. You don't have to be present in order to enjoy the fruits of your labor. Sometimes you can just let your fruit sit and ripen and then go back and enjoy the juiciness. That is it. So with that being said, love and blessings, pray before you lay. I love y'all and good night.